in the moonlight, that had transformed the frozen battle into a scene from a nightmare. Professor Sullivan walked slowly back to his office. He wondered what he had done, and where it would lead. But this, of course, he would never know. Jan might walk this spot again, having given no more than a few months of his life in traveling to the home of the overlords and returning to Earth. Yet if he did so, it would be on the other side of time's impassable barrier, for it would be 80 years in the future. The lights went on in the tiny metal cylinder as soon as Jan Bad closed the inner door of the lock. He allowed himself no time for second thoughts, but began immediately upon the routine check he had already worked out. All the stores and 113 provisions had been loaded days ago, but a final recheck would put him in the right frame of mind, by assuring him that nothing had been left undone. An hour later, he was satisfied. He lay back on the sponge-rubber couch and recapitulated his plans. The only sound was the faint whir of the electric calendar dock, which would warn him when the voyage was coming to its end. He knew that he could expect to feel nothing here in his cell, for whatever tremendous forces drove the ships of the overlords must be perfectly compensated. Sullivan had checked that, pointing out that his tableau would collapse if subjected to more than a few gravities. His dot clients dot had assured him that there was no danger on this score. There would, however, be a considerable change of atmospheric pressure. This was unimportant, since the hollow models could breathe through several orifices. Before he left his cell, Jan would have to equalize pressure, and he had assumed that the atmosphere inside the overlord ship was unbreathable. A simple face dot mask and oxygen set would take care of that. There was no need for anything elaborate. If he could breathe without mechanical aid, so much the better. There was no point in waiting any longer, it would only be a strain on the nerves. He took out the little syringe, already loaded with the carefully prepared solution. Narcosamine had been discovered during research into animal hibernation. It was not true to say, as was popularly believed, that it produced suspended animation. All it caused was a great slowing down of the vital processes, though metabolism still continued at a reduced level. It was as if one had banked up the fires of life, so that they smoldered underground. But when, after weeks or months, the effect of the drug wore off, they would burst out again and the sleeper would revive. Narcosamine was perfectly safe. Nature had used it for a million years to protect many of her children from the foodless winter. So Jan slept. He never felt the tug of the hoisting cables as the huge metal framework was lifted into the hold of the Overlord freighter. He never heard the hatch's dose, not to open again for 300 million kilometers. He never heard, far dot off and faint through the mighty walls, the protesting scream of Earth's atmosphere, as the ship climbed swiftly back to its natural element. And he never felt the star drive go on. 114-14 SU conference room was always crowded for these weekly meetings, but today it was so closely packed that the reporters had difficulty in writing. For the 100th time, they grew inbled to each other at Care Ellen's conservatism and lack of consideration. Anywhere else in the world they could have brought TV cameras, tape recorders, and all the other tools of their highly mechanized trade. But here they had to rely on such archaic devices as paper and pencil dots and even, incredible to relate, shorthand. There had, of course, been several attempts to smuggle in recorders. They had been successfully smuggled out again, but a single glance at their smoking interiors had shown the futility of the experiment. Everyone understood, then, why they had always been warned, in their own interest, to leave watches and other metallic objects outside the conference room. To make things more unfair, Care Ellen himself recorded the whole proceedings. Reporters guilty of carelessness, or downright misrepresentation. Though this was very rare, had been summoned to short and unpleasant sessions with Care Ellen's underlings and required to listen attentively to playbacks of what the supervisor had really said. The lesson was not one that ever had to be repeated. It was strange how these rumors got around. No prior announcement was made, yet there was always a full house whenever Care Ellen had an important statement to make. Which happened, on the average, two or three times a year. Silence descended on the murmuring crowd as the great doorway split open and Care Ellen came forward onto the dais. The light here was dimmed, approximating, no doubt, to that of the Overlord's far distant sun, so that the supervisor for Earth had discarded the dark glasses he normally wore when in the open. He replied to the ragged chorus of greetings with a formal good morning, everybody, then turned to the tall, distinguished figure at the front of the crowd. Mr. Golder, Don of the Press Club, might have been the original inspirer of the butler's announcement. Three reporters, Mullard, and a gentleman from the Times. He dressed and behaved like a diplomat 115 of the old school. No one would ever hesitate to confide in him, and no one had ever regretted it subsequently. Quite a crowd today, Mr. Golder. There must be a shortage of news. The gentleman from the Times smiled and cleared his throat. I hope you can rectify that, Mr. Supervisor. He watched intently as Care Ellen considered his reply. It seemed so unfair that the Overlord's faces, rigid as masks, betrayed no trace of emotion. The great, wide eyes, their pupils sharply contracted even in this indifferent light, stared fathomlessly back into the frankly curious human ones. The twin breathing orifices on either cheek, if those fluted, basalt curves could be called cheeks, emitted the faintest of whistles as Care Ellen's hypothetical lungs labored in the thin air of Earth. Golder could just see the curtain of tiny white hairs fluttering to and fro, keeping accurately out of phase, as they responded to Care Ellen's rapid, double-action breathing cycle. Dust filters, they were generally believed to be, and elaborate theories concerning the atmosphere of the Overlord's home had been constructed on this slender foundation. Yes, I have some news for you. As you are doubtless aware, one of my supplely ships recently left Earth to return to its space. We have just discovered that there was a stowaway on board. 100 pencils break to a halt, 100 pairs of eyes fixed themselves upon Care Ellen. A stowaway, did you say, Mr. Supervisor? Asked Golder. May we ask who he was and how he got aboard? His name is Jan Rodericks. He is an engineering student from the University of Cape Town. Further details you can no doubt discover for yourselves through your own very efficient channels. Care Ellen smiled. The supervisor's smile was a curious affair. Most of the effect really resided in the eyes, the inflexible, lipless mouth scarcely moved at all. Was this, Golder wondered, another of the many human customs that Care Ellen bad copied with such skill? For the total effect was, undoubtedly, that of a smile, and the mind readily accepted it as such. As for how he left, continued the supervisor, that is of secondary importance. I can assure you, or any other potential astronauts, that there is no possibility of repeating the exploit. 116 What will happen to this young man? Persisted Golder. Will he be sent back to Earth? That is outside my jurisdiction, but I expect he will come back off the next ship. He would find conditions too alien. For comfort where he has gone. And this leads me to the main purpose of our meeting today. J.R. Ellen paused, and the silence grew even deeper. There has been some complaint, among the younger and more romantic elements of your population, because outer space has been closed to you. We had a purpose in doing this, we do not impose bans for the pleasure of it. But have you ever stopped to consider, if you will excuse a slightly uttering analogy, what a man from your Stone Age would have felt, if he suddenly found himself in a modern city? Surely, protested the Herald Tribune, there is a fundamental difference. We are accustomed to science. On your world there are doubtless many things which we might not understand, but they wouldn't seem magic to us. Are you quite sure of that? Said Care Ellen, so softly that it was hard to hear his words. Only 100 years lies between the age of electricity and the age of steam, But what would a Victorian engineer have made of a television set or an electronic computer? And how long would he have lived if he started to investigate their workings? The gulf between two technologies can easily become so great that it is lethal. Hello, whispered Reuters to the BBC, we're in luck. He's going to make a major policy statement. I know the symptoms, and there are other reasons why we have restricted the human race to Earth. Watch. The lights dimmed and vanished. As they faded, a milky opalescence formed in the center of the room. It congealed into a whirlpool of stars. A spiral nebula seen from a point far beyond its outermost sun. No human eyes have ever seen this sight before, said Kaer Ellen's voice from the darkness. You aren't looking at your own universe, the island galaxy of which your sun is a member, from a distance of 500,000 light-years. There was a long silence. Then Kaer Ellen continued, and now his voice held something that was not quite pity and not precisely scorn. 117 Your race has shown a notable incapacity for dealing with the problems of its own rather small planet. When we arrived, you were on the point of destroying yourselves with the powers that science had rashly given you. Without our intervention, the Earth today would be a radioactive wilderness. Now you have a world at peace, and a united race. Soon you will be sufficiently civilized to run your planet without our assistance. Perhaps you could eventually handle the problems of an entire solar system, say 50 moons and planets. But do you really imagine that you could ever cope with this? The nebula expanded. Now the individual stars were rushing past, appearing and vanishing as swiftly as sparks from a forge. And each of those transient sparks was a sun, with who knew how many circling worlds. In this single galaxy of ours, murmured Kaer Ellen, there are 80,700,000,000 suns. Even that figure gives only a faint idea of the immensity of space. In challenging it, you would be like ants attempting to label and classify all the grains of sand in all the deserts of the world. Your race, in its present stage of evolution, cannot face that stupendous challenge. One of my duties has been to protect you from the powers and forces that lie among the stars. Froze beyond anything that you can ever imagine. The image of the galaxy's swirling fire dot mists faded, light returned to the sudden silence of the great chamber. Kaer Ellen turned to go. The audience was over. At the door he paused and looked back upon the hushed crowd. It is a bitter thought, but you must face it. The planets you may one day possess. But the stars are not for man. The stars are not for man. Yes, it would annoy them to have the celestial portals slammed in their faces. But they must learn to face the truth, or as much of the truth as could mercifully be given to them. From the lonely heights of the stratosphere, Kaer Ellen looked lone upon the world and the people that had been given into his reluctant keeping. He thought of all that lay ahead, and what this world would be only a dozen years from now. They would never know how lucky they had been. For a 118 lifetime, mankind had achieved as much happiness as any race can ever know. It had been the golden age. But gold was also the color of sunset, of autumn, and only Kaer Ellen's ears could catch the first wailings of the winter storms. And only Kaer Ellen knew with what inexorable swiftness the golden age was rushing to its close. 119 meters, the last generation 15, look at this. Exploded George Gregson, hurling the paper across at Jean. It came to rest, despite her efforts to intercept it, spread listlessly across the breakfast table. Jean patiently scraped away the jam and read the offending passage, doing her best to register disapproval. She was not very good at this, because all too often she agreed with the critics. Usually she kept these heretical opinions to herself, and not merely for the sake of peace and quiet. George was perfectly prepared to accept praise from her, or anyone else, but if she ventured any criticism of his work she would receive a crushing lecture on her artistic ignorance. She read the review twice, then gave up. It appeared quite favorable, and she said so. He seemed to like the performance. What are you grumbling about? "This," snarled George, stubbing his finger at the middle of the column. "Just read it again." Particularly restful on the eyes were the delicate pastel greens of the background to the ballet sequence. "Well?" "They weren't greens. I spent a lot of time getting that exact shade of blue." "And what happens?" "Either some blasted engineer in the control room upsets the color balance, or that idiot of a reviewer's got a cock-eyed set. Hey, what color did it look on our receiver?" "I can't remember," confessed Jean. "The poppet started squealing about then and I had to go and find what was wrong with her." "Oh," said George, relapsing into a gently simmering quiescence. Jean knew that another eruption could be expected at any moment. When it came, however, it was fairly mild. "I've invented a new definition for TV," he muttered 120 gloomily. "I've decided it's a device for hindering communication between artist and audience." "What do you want to do about it?" retorted Jean. "Go back to the live theater?"
"And why not?"
asked George. "That's exactly what I had been thinking about. You know that letter I received from the New Athens people? They've written to me again. This time I'm going to answer."
"Indeed?"
said Jean, faintly alarmed. "I think they're a lot of cranks." "Well, there's only one way to find out. I intend to go and see them in the next fortnight. I must say that the literature they put out looks perfectly sane. And they've got some very good men there. If you expect me to start cooking over a wood fire, or learning to dress in skins, you'll have—"
"Oh, don't be silly. Those stories are just nonsense. The colony's got everything that's really needed for civilized life. They don't believe in unnecessary frills, that's all. Anyway, it's a couple of years since I visited the Pacific, it will make a trip for us both."
"I agree with you there," said Jean. "But I don't intend Junior and the poppet to grow up into a couple of Polynesian savages."
"They won't," said George.
"I can promise you that." He was right, though not in the way he had intended. "As you noticed when you flew in," said the little man on the other side of the veranda, "the colony consists of two islands, linked by a causeway. This is Athens, the other we've christened Sparta. It's rather wild and rocky, and is a wonderful place for sport or exercise." His eye flickered momentarily over his visitor's waistline, and George squirmed slightly in the cane chair. "Sparta is an extinct volcano, by the way. At least the geologists say it's extinct, ha. But back to Athens. The idea of the colony, as you've gathered, is to build up an independent, stable cultural group with its own artistic traditions. I should point out that a vast amount of research took place before we started this enterprise. It's really a piece of applied social engineering, based on some exceedingly complex mathematics which I wouldn't pretend 121 to understand. All I know is that the mathematical sociologists have computed how large the colony should be, how many types of people it should contain, and, above all, what constitution it should have furlong-term stability. We're ruled by a council of 8 directors, representing production, power, social engineering, art, economics, science, sport, and philosophy. There's no permanent chairman or president. The chair's held by each of the directors in rotation for a year at a time. Our present population is just over 50,000, which is a little short of the desired optimum. That's why we keep our eyes open for recruits. And, of course, there is a certain wastage. We're not yet quite self-supporting in some of the more specialized talents. Here on this island we're trying to save something of humanity's independence, its artistic traditions. We've no hostility towards the overlords, we simply want to be left alone to go our own way. When they destroyed the old nations and the way of life man had known since the beginning of history, they swept away many good things with the bad. The world's now placid, featureless and culturally dead. Nothing really new has been created since the overlords came. The reason's obvious.
There's nothing left to struggle for, and there are too many distractions and entertainments. Do you realize that every day something like 500 hours of radio and TV pour out over the various channels? If you went without sleep and did nothing else, you could follow less than a 20th of the entertainment that's available at the turn of a switch. No wonder that people are becoming passive sponges, absorbing but never creating. Did you know that the average viewing time per person is now 3 hours a day? Soon people won't be living their own lives anymore. It will be a full-time job keeping up with the various family serials on TV. Here, in Athens, entertainment takes its proper place. Moreover, it's live, not canned. In a community this size, it is possible to have almost complete audience participation, with all that means to the performers and artists. Incidentally, we've got a very fine symphony orchestra, probably among the world's half dozen best. But I don't want you to take my word for this. What usually happens is that prospective citizens stay here a few 122 days, getting the feel of the place. If they decide they'd like to join us, then we let them take the battery of psychological tests, which are really or mainly off defense. About a third of the applicants are rejected, usually for reasons which don't reflect on them and which wouldn't matter outside. Those who pass go home long enough to settle their affairs, and then rejoin us. Sometimes, they change their minds at this stage, but that's very unusual and almost invariably through personal reasons outside their control. Our tests are practically 100% reliable now. The people they pass are the people who really want to come. Suppose anyone changed their mind later? Asks Jean anxiously. Then they could leave. There'd be no difficulty. It's happened once or twice. There was a long silence. Jean looked at George, who was rubbing thoughtfully at the side. Whiskers currently popular in artistic circles. As long as they weren't burning their boats behind them, she was not unduly worried. The colony looked an interesting place, and certainly wasn't as cranky as she'd feared. And the children would love it. That, in the final analysis, was all that mattered. They moved in 6 weeks later. The single-storied house was small, but quite adequate for a family which had no intention of being greater than four. All the basic labor-saving devices were in evidence, at least, Jean admitted. There was no danger of reverting to the dark ages of domestic drudgery. It was slightly disturbing, however, to discover that there was a kitchen. In a community of this size, one would normally expect to dial Food Central, wait 5 minutes, and then get whatever meal they had selected. Individuality was all very well, but this, Jean feared, might be taking things a little too far. She wondered darkly if she would be expected to make the family's clothes as well as to prepare its meals. But there was no spinning dot wheel between the automatic dishwasher and the radar range, so it wasn't quite as bad as that. Of course, the rest of the house still looked very bare and raw. They were its first occupants, and it would be some time before all this aseptic newness had been converted into a warm, human home. The children, doubtless, would catalyze the 123 process rather effectively. There was already, though Jean did not know it yet, an unfortunate victim of Jeffrey's expiring in the bath, as a result of that young man's ignorance of the fundamental difference between fresh and salt water. Jean moved to the still uncurtained window and looked across the colony. It was a beautiful place, there was no doubt of that. The house stood on the western slopes of the low bill that dominated, because of the absence of any other competition, the island of Athens. 2 kilometers to the north, she could see the causeway. A thin knife edge dividing the water. That led to Sparta. That rocky island, with its brooding volcanic cone, was such a contrast to this peaceful spot that it sometimes frightened her. She wondered how the scientists could be so certain that it would never reawaken and overwhelm them all. A wavering figure coming up the slope, keeping carefully to the palm-trees shade in defiance of the rule of the road, attracted her eye. George was returning from his first conference. It was time to stop daydreaming and get busy about the house. A metallic crash announced the arrival of George's bicycle. Jean wondered how long it was going to take them both to learn to ride. This was yet another unexpected aspect of life on the island. Private cars were not permitted, and indeed were unnecessary, since the greatest distance one could travel in a straight line was less than 15 kilometers. There were various community-owned service vehicles, trucks, ambulances, and fire-engines, all restricted, except in cases of real emergency, to 50 kilometers an hour. As a result, the inhabitants of Athens had plenty of exercise, uncongested streets, and no traffic accidents. George gave his wife a perfunctory peck and collapsed with a sigh of relief into the nearest chair. "Phew," he said, mopping his brow. "Everyone raced past me on the way up the hill, so I suppose people do get used wit. I think I've lost 10 kilograms already." "What sort of a day did you have?" asked Jean dutifully. She hoped George would not be too exhausted to help with the unpacking. "Very stimulating. Of course one can't remember half the people I met, but they all seemed very pleasant. And the theater is just as good as I'd hoped. We're starting work next 124-week onshores back to Methuselah. I'll be in complete charge of sets and stage design. It'll make a change, not having a dozen people to tell me what I can't do. Yes, I think we're going to like it here." "Despite the bicycles?" George summoned up enough energy to grin. "Yes," he said. "In a couple of weeks I won't even notice this little hill of ours." He didn't really believe it, but it was perfectly true. It was another month, however, before Jean ceased to pine for the car, and discovered all the things one could do with one's own kitchen. New Athens was not a natural and spontaneous growth like the city whose name it bore. Everything about the colony was deliberately planned, as the result of many years of study by a group of very remarkable men. It had begun as an open conspiracy against the overlords, an implicit challenge to their policy if not to their power. At first the colony's sponsors had been more than half certain that Kaer Allen would neatly frustrate them, but the supervisor had done nothing, absolutely nothing. This was not quite as reassuring as might have been expected. Kaer Allen had plenty of time, he might be preparing a delayed counterstroke. Or he might be so certain of the project's failure that he felt no need to take any action against it. That the colony would fail had been the prediction of most people. Yet even in the past, long before any real knowledge of social dynamics had existed, there had been many communities devoted to special religious or philosophical ends. It was true that their mortality rate had been high, but some had survived. And the foundations of New Athens were as secure as modern science could make them. There were many reasons for choosing an island site. Not the least important was psychological. In an age of universal air transport, the ocean meant nothing as a physical barrier, but it still gave a sense of isolation. Moreover, a limited land area made it impossible for too many people to live in the colony. The maximum population was fixed at 100,000, more than that, and the advantages inherent in a small, compact community would be lost. One of the aims of the founders was that any member of New Athens should 125 know all the other citizens who shared his interests, and as many as 1 or 2% of the remainder as well. The man who had been the driving force behind New Athens was a Jew. And, like Moses, he had never lived to enter his promised land, for the colony had been founded 3 years after his death. He had been born in Israel, the last independent nation ever to come into existence, and, therefore, the shortest lived. The end of national sovereignty had been felt here perhaps more bitterly than anywhere else, for it is hard to lose a dream which one has just achieved after centuries of striving. Ben Salomon was no fanatic, but the memories of his childhood must have determined, to no small extent, the philosophy he was to put into practice. He could just remember what the world had been before the advent of the overlords, and had no wish to return to it. Like not a few other intelligent and well-meaning men,
He could appreciate all that Kaer-El had done for the human race, while still being unhappy about the supervisor's ultimate plans.